This is one of the seminars in a series on workplace law. It's presented by Greens List, and the topic this morning is going to look at the adverse action under the Fair Work Act, what it is and what are some of the legal issues and some of the practical issues which face practitioners. Now, there are a number of presenters this morning, and in order of seniority, I think, there's Tim Donaghy. Now, Tim has been around a long time, and in particularly in this area of the law has been around a long time. He is a published author, and I think, according to Tim, and I wasn't up to date on this, the second edition of his book, Termination of Employment, has now come out. The first edition was published in 2006. When I was trying to find out whether the second edition had come out, I typed his name into Google, and Tim Donaghy has published a book on, I think, the bodybuilding.com forum, but this is a different Tim. Now, the second speaker in order of seniority is Jim McKenna. Hasn't been around as long as Tim, but has extensive experience in this area. Not only extensive experience as counsel in this area, but Jim also is a sessional lecturer at Monash. He's got a Master of Laws. He'll be our main presenter this morning, and he's written the paper, and that is in the handout that you would have got as you came in. I was saying not only has he got extensive experience as counsel in this area, but also as an academic, and it is because of Jim that that this seminar in the series of seminars is in August. We needed to slot it in before his illness was exacerbated by the September failure. You might have seen he's a member of the Collingwood Industrial Magpies group. So we'll get it over and done with before he goes into depression. And the last speaker we have is someone who's relatively new to the bar, but also who has extensive experience in the area. That's Angus Galbraith. He's got a broad practice, but included in that broad practice at the bar, as well as in his practice as a solicitor, he's practiced in employment and industrial law practice. And we've invited Angus because if it wasn't Angus here, I would be the only one who didn't have a book published or have some academic qualification in addition to the basic degrees. So now, in terms of how the matter will run this morning, we're going to ask Jim to talk, and at about 8 o'clock, we'll have a short break for coffee, and then we'll have a bit of a panel discussion thereafter. There's some matters that each of us have seen have been raised from Jim's paper, and if any of you have questions or matters about which you want to have a discussion, welcome to raise them then. So now I'd like to welcome Jim McKenna.
Thank you, Eugene. Eugene informed me when we were organising this breakfast that he's a former member of the Fitzroy Football Club. So at least my team still exists. I have a relatively short time this morning. Thank you all for coming along and facing up to general protections at 7:35 in the morning. I've prepared a paper that deals with essentially what I'm going to want to talk about for the next 25 minutes, a half an hour or so. It's reasonably technical and reasonably heavy. And as I say, thank you for your attendance, and I hope that it's not too painful. The purpose of this morning of the first half of the session is to give an overview really of the nuts and bolts of the legislation and how that's played out in the courts over the last three or so years. Three and a half, almost 4 years now over 4 years since these provisions were introduced. And essentially focus on what is prohibited. What is prohibited and what is protected under Part 3.1 of the Fair Work Act, focusing specifically on workplace rights. Now, the part general protections, as a lot of you would be aware, draws together a number of concepts that existed prior to the Fair Work Act, unlawful termination, freedom of association, but it also covers issues like sham contractors and introduces a new federal discrimination jurisdiction. Now, discrimination under Part 3.1 is to be the subject of a later Greens breakfast seminar, so I'll try not to deal with it, although I quite like discrimination, so I might find myself getting sucked into that a little bit. But you'll all have to come along in a month or two when that part of the seminar is run. The area of general protections is one which seemed to take a little while to take off. It took a long while for any authority to really come through the courts, and the Fair Work Commission publishes the statistics of the number of applications that have been filed and how many certificates have been issued and how many have resolved and whatnot. And what those figures bear out is a steady increase from 2009 until now, where in the last quarter there were almost 900 of these applications filed, which is quite a significant number. Of those 900, about 750 related to terminations, to dismissals, and about 150 or so were the balance of the applications. Interestingly as well, of those 750 or so related to termination, only 200 produced certificates. So there are only 200 of those applications which either didn't settle or were withdrawn at the commission stage. And then, of course, a number of those would have obviously fallen out before they got to the federal courts as well. So the numbers are quite high, but the number of applications that hit the courts are obviously significantly lower than those that are filed. And that's probably also borne out by the figures in relation to unfair dismissals. There's some 3,500 unfair dismissal applications last quarter and only 36 successful orders published by the Commission. Now, as I mentioned, this morning I want to focus on the core provisions of Part 3.1 and specifically on adverse action because of a workplace right under Section 340. The way that those provisions function is essentially the same as the prohibition against industrial activity because of a workplace right and the prohibition against discrimination. On a simple level, the way the Act functions is quite simple. It prohibits adverse action because of a prohibited reason. So that part of it is reasonably simple. The three more complicated issues that fall out of that are: what is adverse action? What is a prohibited reason? In this instance, what is a workplace right? And when will adverse action be taken because of a workplace right? And I want to deal with each of those three issues separately. What is adverse action? The Fair Work Act helpfully provides a table that tells us exactly what is adverse action. And importantly, it's not limited only to action taken by an employer against an employee. There are seven categories in total of different types of adverse action. And within each of those categories, adverse action is defined. So not only does it relate to action taken by employers against employees, it relates to action by prospective employers against prospective employees, principals against contractors, prospective principals against prospective contractors, contractors against principals, and industrial associations against persons. Now, that being said, this morning I will focus on the type of adverse action that is action taken by an employer against an employee, because that is by far the most commonly litigated type of adverse action. And within that area, adverse action is defined in four ways. It arises where an employer dismisses an employee, where an employer injures an employee in his or her employment, where an employer alters the position of the employee to the employee's prejudice, and where the employer discriminates between the employee and other employees of the employer. I'll deal with each of them in turn. The employer dismisses an employee. Now, the Fair Work Commission figures suggest that this is 85% of all applications, of all general protection applications filed, include a termination. So this is the majority, the great majority of applications include a termination. May well include other allegations of adverse action as well, but they will include a termination. Now, dismissed is defined under the Fair Work Act, And according to the explanatory memorandum, it's defined in a way that is intended to pick up the common law meaning of constructive dismissal, which is set out in authorities like Moserhab and Dick Smith Electronics, which is essentially that had the employer not taken the action that they had, the employee would have remained in the employment relationship. Now, the definition has a second limb, which talks about the employee being forced to resign. Now, this also seems to be directed at constructive dismissal. There doesn't appear to be any authority in the courts that talk about whether the definition in the Act changes the common law meaning of dismissal and constructive dismissal. The Commission says that, no, it's one and the same. There is some academic commentary to suggest that the inclusion of the word forced means something else and might change the Act in some way, but to date there's been no suggestion from the courts that that's the case. The next two limbs of adverse action, injury, employment and prejudicial alteration, are tests that have existed in federal industrial legislation for quite some time. Notwithstanding that, because of the frequency with which adverse action and general protections are now being litigated, the law is evolving further and continuing to develop. The fundamental tests for those two limbs, though, really are drawn from the Patrick's MUA case from 1998 or whenever it was. And that defines injury as being... an employer will have injured an employee in his or her employment if it subjects him or her to an injury of any compensable kind. And prejudicial alteration is defined as a broad additional category which covers not only a legal injury, but any adverse affectation of or deterioration in the advantages enjoyed by the employee before the conduct in question. And it may arise, notwithstanding that the employee suffers no loss or infringement of a legal right, but it arises or it will occur if the alteration to the position is real and substantial rather than possible or hypothetical. So what does that mean? The most common species of adverse action falling within these limbs that have been litigated recently includes investigations of employees, and the authority now, the vast weight of authority suggests that an investigation of an employee where that investigation's termination is a possible outcome of that investigation, that will amount to a prejudicial alteration of a position, even if the proceeding, the investigation is brought in good faith. Suspension of an employee on pay and providing an employee with a final written warning have also been found to amount to adverse action. Now, a couple of brief additional points on that. Action for the purpose of those limbs can include inaction. However, there is authority to suggest that things like a failure to provide procedural fairness when moving towards termination itself does not amount to adverse action unless that employee has a right, unless they are able to identify the source of a right of that procedural fairness. Now, the fourth limb of adverse action is discrimination. The employer discriminates between the employee and other employees of the employer. Now, this is a one area that really is new to the federal industrial legislation. And it also must be, it's important not to confuse discrimination as a type of adverse action from the prohibition against taking adverse action because of a person's race, sex, gender, age, that sort of thing. That discrimination, as it's defined in Section 351, is concerned with adverse action taken because of a protected attribute like age, sex, race. Discrimination as it arises as a type of adverse action is concerned simply with different treatment. It doesn't matter that the reason for the different treatment does not arise for consideration at that point. It is, of course, very relevant when one turns to consider whether the adverse action is because of a protected reason. But for determining whether adverse action is taken where the discriminatory adverse action is taken, it doesn't, the causal issue is not raised. Now, what then is discrimination? There's very little case law at this point. There is one federal magistrate's or federal circuit judge's decision that I'm aware of, and a decision of Justice Gordon in Klein and the MFB. And from those, what one can distill is that discrimination amounts to treating an employee or a group of employees less favourably than other employees, which can include singling employees out for different treatment. Importantly, it's not limited to direct discrimination. So it's not limited to circumstances where action of an employer has a... where an employer treats employees differently. It also extends to conduct which has disparate impact. So not only... So I've spent some time trying to develop a useful hypothetical situation to work through indirect discrimination in these circumstances. And it's quite hard, and I've come up with something, but I presume that probably half the room and all of the panel are going to drive a truck through it. But if we have a situation with an employer and their employees and the union in EBA negotiations, and the union or employees want to apply for a good faith bargaining order, and the matter is listed in the Fair Work Commission for the hearing of that order in 2 weeks' time. And the employer goes to his or her employees and says, in 2 weeks' time, anybody who completes all their work for the week, meets all their quotas, is going to get a $50 bonus. Now, that on its face is neutral. That on its face doesn't discriminate between anyone who's involved in the dispute. But if there are half a dozen employees who are going to be sitting in the commission giving evidence in that week, their ability to meet their quotas and to get all their job done will be reduced. So on that analysis, I think it's arguable that even though there's not direct discrimination, the impact of the treatment would have different consequences on people who are taking part in that proceeding, which, for reasons I'll get to, is exercising a workplace right. Two other brief comments I want to make about discrimination, and in particular indirect discrimination. Where indirect discrimination arises under equal opportunity legislation, it's always subject to the caveat that it's not unlawful if indirect discrimination is reasonable. Now, that carve-out doesn't exist under the Fair Work Act. However, indirect discrimination under other equal opportunity legislation is not concerned with the reason for the treatment. All it's concerned with is condition requirements or practice that has disparate impact that's not reasonable. Here, for the discriminatory adverse action to be unlawful, it must be taken because of a prohibited reason. And so for that reason, it probably indirect discrimination has much less work to do in this jurisdiction. Now, so moving to the second issue, what then are the prohibited reasons? And as I said, I want to focus on Section 340, although Part 3.1 sets out a number of different other types of prohibited reasons. But Section 340 prohibits taking adverse action against a person because the person has a workplace right, has or has not exercised a workplace right, proposes or does not propose to exercise a workplace right. It also prohibits taking adverse action against a person to prevent them from exercising a workplace right or because a third person has exercised a workplace right on their behalf. Now, before I jump into some of the authorities on this and work through some of the definitions, I just want to take a step back for 2 seconds and look at what it appears that this part of the legislation is trying to achieve. Shortly before the introduction of this legislation, there was a number of decisions that involved what was meant by making an application or making a complaint to a competent administrative authority. One of them, Claveria or CSR, and CSR reading Claveria, involved a situation where an employee complained to their union about treatment by a supervisor and then was terminated because of making that complaint. Now, at first instance, the federal court said, yes, that is making a complaint to a competent administrative authority, and that was overturned on appeal. I had a brief in a similar sort of scenario where an employee had called up the Work Choices info line, found out that they were being underpaid, went to their boss and said, "Boss, you're underpaying me $2 an hour." Their boss said, "Thank you so much for bringing that to my attention. I'll make sure that that's remedied." And then that person subsequently went from 3 shifts to 2 shifts to 1 shift to no shift over the next month. Now, it would be very, very difficult to bring that sort of conduct within the old test of filing a complaint, participating in a proceeding, or having recourse to competent administrative authorities. So that, in my view, is what this concept of a workplace right is directed towards. Having a workplace right, raising that, exercising that, or in a situation where an employer knows that that is going to be raised or exercised, and then adverse action is taken because of that. So then, moving through the more technical elements of what is a workplace right, Section 341 1A and B deal with the meaning of a workplace right and relate to workplace law and instruments and prohibit adverse action where a person is entitled to the benefit of, have a role or responsibility under, or are able to initiate, participate, or proceeding under a workplace law or workplace instrument. So then, what is a workplace law? Well, it's not regulations. It must be an enactment. It doesn't have to be a law that is solely devoted to employment. So, for example, the Equal Opportunity Act, the State Equal Opportunity Act, deals with discrimination in a whole range of areas, one of which is employment. But to the extent that it does deal with employment, that would be a workplace law. It does not extend to legislation that uses the status of the employer to impose duties. And the example which has been determined by the High Court is that a piece of legislation that requires an employee to report a fault, a defect in an aircraft, that itself does not amount to a workplace law. As to a workplace instrument, that essentially is something that is made under, recognised by a workplace law and concerns a relationship between employers and employees. Importantly, neither workplace laws or workplace instruments extend to employment contracts. So to the extent that an employee may have a right to something that arises under contract, that does not form the basis of a workplace right under Section 341 1A and B. To the extent that it does under the next limb is something that's probably a little bit contentious at the moment. So what's an example of someone having a benefit to a workplace law or instrument? That's probably reasonably clear. So someone who is entitled to a minimum wage under an award, that is a benefit of a workplace law or instrument. A role or responsibility under a workplace law or a workplace instrument, someone who is an OH&S representative, or in the example of Jones and QTAC, a bargaining representative under the Fair Work Act. And in relation to the ability or intention to participate in a process or proceeding under a workplace law, process or proceedings under a workplace law is defined in Section 341(2). I won't go through it now. It involves commission and court proceedings, essentially industrial activity relating to bargaining and other specific examples, and ends with a catch-all that states any other process or proceeding under a workplace law or workplace instrument. So the final limb of a workplace right is Section 341(1)(c), and that provides that a person has a workplace right if the person is able to make a complaint or inquiry, limb Roman 1, to a person or body having capacity under a workplace law to seek compliance with that law or workplace instrument, or Roman 2, if the person is an employee in relation to his or her employment. Now, focusing on the second limb, Federal Court has looked at that limb and said, well, this is very broad, without analysing it in any further detail. Practical examples that have arisen in the Federal Circuit Court or Federal Magistrates Court that have amounted to, I'm getting the 5 minute buzzer, that have amounted to this sort of workplace right include complaints about inter-office issues, workplace conflicts, extremely broad. The meaning of complaint has been read somewhat more narrowly, been found to require a statement of particular finding of fault as opposed to a mere request for assistance. Although the word inquiry is obviously cast much, much more broadly. I haven't been able to find any authority on it, but the dictionary defines it as seeking information by questioning. Extremely broad. Now, the requirement that the complaint or inquiry be in relation to employment is also a reasonably low threshold. The courts have said, well, that can be a direct or indirect relationship. And so 341(1)(c) Roman 2 on its face is extremely broad. Perhaps because of that breadth, there is a federal magistrate or federal circuit court decision that says that the two limbs under section 341(c) must be read as cumulative rather than disjunctive. And the citation for that's in the paper. I've been pointed out by two people this morning that there is more recent authority by another federal magistrate or federal circuit judge who disagrees with that approach. So it is at the moment subject to differing authority and obviously we're presumably waiting for someone, hopefully someone in the room perhaps, to run that in the federal court and get some clarity. So in 3 minutes, when is adverse action taken because of a prohibited reason? This has been dealt with by the High Court quite recently in Barclay. A lot of us would be familiar with that decision. And what the High Court there say that it's a question of fact to be determined in light of all the relevant circumstances. And the relevant question will be, why was the applicant treated as he or she was? Apparently it's very simple. I think we're going to talk about it a little bit more in the panel discussion, so I won't labour it now. Safe to say there are two very important statutory provisions that affect the court's determination of that question of why. The first is that under Section 360, the reason, the prohibited reason, the workplace right, need not be the sole or dominant reason. It's sufficient that it be a substantial and operative reason. The legislation itself says the reasons, it's prohibited if the reasons included that prohibited reason. The courts have said, well, it must be a substantial operative reason. Secondly, and probably most controversially, is the existence of the reverse onus. Now, it's not sufficient for... a court must not only be established that there was adverse action, that the prohibited reason, the workplace right, existed. Court must also be satisfied that the adverse action was taken because of the workplace right or prohibited reason. Now, quite often in courts, there's a lot of time taken up by arguing the preliminary issues, whether the action amounted to adverse action. But the crux of the issue is really that issue of causation. Was the adverse action because of the workplace right? Now, the policy behind the reverse onus is discussed in General Motors Holden and Bowling. And it's in the paper, but the provision, General Motors Holden provides a great example of where the reverse onus does some work. It involves an employee who was dismissed. The operations manager came along to court and said he was dismissed for his conduct, but it came out in evidence that the people who ultimately made the decision weren't the person standing in the witness box, but another two directors. And where the decision makers are not called, it is virtually impossible, perhaps not completely impossible, but virtually impossible to discharge that onus. So one of the complex questions that then arises from that and from the existence of the reverse onus is who made the decision? And there's a really interesting recent decision by Justice Gray, in fact his last before retiring, that looks closely at, well, who was a decision maker in a certain circumstance, NTEU and RMIT. And in that case, His Honour was looking at a decision that was ultimately made by the Vice-Chancellor of RMIT to make an academic redundant in circumstances where two other employees of the university had signed off on that decision at an earlier stage and had forwarded it on to the Vice-Chancellor. And in those circumstances, Justice Gray found those early decision-makers to be an essential part of the ultimate decision and held that a failure to call those employees contributed to the inability to discharge the onus. Now, procedural issues, I'm going to deal with this in 30 seconds. Application involving a dismissal must be filed within 21 days. It used to be 60 until the start of this year. Ostley still says 60. I think, last time I looked. It's 21. Involving a dismissal, proceeding involving a dismissal, one would go to the Fair Work Commission, have a conciliation. If the conciliation is unsuccessful, obtain a certificate. Once the certificate is obtained, the applicant has 14 days to bring the application to the Federal Court or the Federal Circuit Court. The exception to that is matters involving an application for an injunction, in which case an applicant can go straight to the federal courts. For matters that do not involve a dismissal, the normal time limit under the Fair Work Act applies, 6 years. So that's anything that does not involve a dismissal has the longer time period. But if there's a range of adverse action alleged and one of those adverse actions is dismissal, then the 21 days will be applied and can only be extended in exceptional circumstances. The only concluding remarks that I wish to make are that this is an area that has grown quite rapidly since it was introduced a relatively short time ago. The Liberal Party, the Coalition, in their election, in their policy material on IR, don't mention general protections and state that, save for the areas identified in that policy document, they have no plans to make any changes. Of course, that appears to be all subject to a productivity commission. So in the event that, whatever happens with the election next month, this is an area that will exist in some shape or form for at least the foreseeable future. So it is an important area. And a survey of the high-profile applications that have been brought suggests that it's really, Mickey Arthur and Cricket Australia was brought as a general protections application. Saw someone shaking their head. Probably rightly so. The Royal Prank DJs, whatever, I don't recall her name, but the Austereo application has also been brought as a general protections application. James Ashby, Peter Slipper, general protections application. The only high profile case in this sort of area that I could find that was not brought as a general protections application was the Fraser Kirk McGuinness one, which was a TPA claim. Now, but even with a TPA claim, it could have been brought as a general protections and then the TPA claim brought in the current jurisdiction of the federal court. It is an extremely useful mechanism for applicants to get before a member of the Fair Work Commission within a couple of weeks to get a mediation. And it seems to be used for that area, for that reason. And it has a flow-on effect that is, a lot of these are being brought, a lot of them are settling, but a lot of them are now also being litigated. And as people who practice in this area, my view is that the importance of these applications is only going to increase in the near future. So I'm sorry that I've run a bit over time, but I think we have time for a coffee.